And our sermon text is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verses 1 to 12. Page 556 in your pew Bible. Ecclesiastes 6, 1 to 12. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. Do not all go to the one place. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? One of the most difficult issues in pastoral ministry is the child who dies in infancy, at birth, or is stillborn. From Elizabeth Carney and her book, The Miscarriage Manual, Elizabeth says this, 14 years ago I gave birth to a baby girl. 4 hours later she died because of an internal malformation that was undetectable during my pregnancy. During my short hospital stay, nurses and doctors seemed to avoid me and my questions. What they did say was about the same as what my friends and family were saying. You're young. You'll have other babies. Try to forget. I didn't want any other baby. I wanted that one. Forget? How could I forget? Instead, I was overwhelmed with crushing, breathtaking grief. I remember how empty I felt that day I left the hospital. An empty womb and empty arms. I never really knew her, but I missed her and ached for her so desperately, she says. Very poignant story, isn't it? But it was only the beginning of her journey. She says the ache never goes away. Other babies do not make it go away. You will never forget about it, and it was possible that no one else can comfort you, even your husband. In fact, some marriages don't survive. When this happens in a family, it proves to be one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult, issue in a pastor's ministry. Two, there are so many questions. Why did this happen to us? Did we do something wrong? Is God upset with us? Where is our baby now? That's a major question. Where is our baby now? Is he or she in heaven or in hell? And there are no truly easy answers here. Many pastors, in an effort to be compassionate, they try to assure the parents that their children are in heaven no matter what. Don't fret your little heart. Little so-and-so is in a better place, right? You hear that constantly. I've heard some Roman Catholics say he's in the cradle of Mother Mary. in an effort to be compassionate. After all, they're just innocent children, aren't they? Innocent children? But of course, biblically, we know, especially as Reformed Christian, that this is sentimental nonsense. We know quite well that men are all true sons of their first father, Adam, and they're born in sin with a fallen nature, what St. Augustine termed original sin. What then, dear listener? Do we say categorically that all such children are in hell? Many have extrapolated by theological inference that this indeed is the case. But this is entirely unsatisfactory, I submit to you, lacking biblical evidence. Others try to assure grieving parents from the experience of David, of course, that since he declares, when he lost his son at birth, he cannot come to me, but I will go to him. And therefore extrapolate that all babies are in heaven with God. This is the strongest biblical evidence, but by no means conclusive in my mind. No means conclusive at all. But in my years of study and reflection on this and in ministry, I have two conclusions, and I just offer them to you. Number one, baptized covenant youth are with the Lord. Baptized covenant youth are with the Lord. And this is an assurance that I bring to parents of baptized covenant youth. I'm a strong, unequivocal believer in the covenant faithfulness of God. This is His economy. This is the way He works. He can be trusted to fulfill His promise to parents faithful to His covenant. Therefore, youth baptized into the covenant are His. They don't have to walk forward in a meeting and pray the sinner's prayer. They don't have to act to take the pastor's class and have First Communion. They are His by virtue of being in covenant with Christ. For this, there's good biblical and theological evidence to my mind. In this I trust, in this I lean, in this I counsel parents. It's not the baptism, not the rite of baptism itself that unites them with Christ. Indeed, Christ, in His own sovereign timing, unites people, children, believers, if you will, children of believers to Himself, in His own sovereign timing. Baptism is the sign and seal of that. It either looks forward or backwards to the time when indeed the Holy Spirit, mysteriously in His own sovereign timing, unites little Elizabeth, for example, to Christ. What we did here last week declares that, does it not? Does it not declare that before God and man? That indeed this child is a covenant child. So, number one, I assure and counsel parents, baptized covenant youth are with the Lord. Second conclusion that I've come to in these years, never easy. All others, I trust to the sovereign, wise counsel of God's will. The rest, unbaptized youth, pagan youth, all others I trust to the sovereign, wise counsel of God's will. I refuse to pronounce categorically whether unbaptized youth are in heaven or hell. God has simply chosen not to extrapolate with any great specificity on this subject, hasn't He? The dearth of biblical evidence leaves me to counsel parents of unbaptized infants to trust in the good pleasure of God's own will. God is all-wise and all-powerful. He has done this for His glory and our good, ultimately. Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Then leave the destiny of your now-deceased baby to Him. But this is why I strongly encourage parents to, number one, enter into covenant with God first yourselves, you and your spouse, by confessing Jesus Christ as your Savior. Do this first. And then secondly, swiftly bring your covenant youth to the baptismal font in obedience, right? We saw this in our covenant families, haven't we, recently? Little Greta and little Elizabeth. John Murray says, I do not baptize children because I am permitted to do so. I baptize children because I'm commanded to do so. So demonstrate your faith in God's covenant economy, in His bountiful goodness, His love, and His mercy, and His grace, by witnessing before God and men that you believe it. Bring your covenant youth to the baptismal font. Baptize your naturally rebellious, whining, selfish, sinful little Adamic creature. And witness to the world, both the visible and invisible world. You are witnessing in the sacraments to both the visible and invisible world. That you trust that God redeems all that we biblically claim for Him. Especially our covenant children. Now in our text today, Koheleth lifts up before our eyes an example of the stillborn child. He has a different purpose than ours. I've never really spoken or preached on this, so I thought I probably need at this point in my ministry to just lay out the conclusions that I've come to, my thoughts on these things. But Koheleth lifts up before our eyes an example of the stillborn child. And he has a different purpose than ours. He wishes to contrast the relatively blessed condition of this little one in comparison to the rich, flourishing, fat adult who ostensibly should be having a rollicking good time with all of his wealth. Yet this one brief, fleeting creature, vaporous, right, in perfect harmony with the theme that we've been teasing out of Ecclesiastes, this one brief, fleeting, vaporous creature is somehow better off than him. How can this be? How can this be? Let's look to our text today. Basic three-point outline. Point number one, ephemeral. In perfect harmony with the theme of Ecclesiastes 2. Ephemeral. That is fleeting. What seems to be stationary, permanent, is actually fleeting and temporary. Ephemeral. There is great irony in the destiny of the rich man in that the fleeting life of the stillborn is happier than his. Verses 1 through 6. It's not that there is not irony in Ecclesiastes. We find plenty of irony, not in the places we first suspect with vanity, vanity, meaningless, meaningless, no. But there is irony aplenty in Ecclesiastes. And here we see there's great irony in the destiny of the rich man and that the fleeting life of the stillborn is happier than his. Biblical literature is filled with the genre of the unfortunate rich man, isn't it? The unfortunate rich man. We have observed this already in chapter 4, verses 7 and 8, in the man with riches, with no heir, with whom to bequeath his riches. And then just last week we saw the man with an heir, but no riches to share with his heir. The entire book of Job is a kind of unfortunate rich man parable. And then, of course, in the New Testament, we have all kinds of them. The parable of the rich man who built bigger barns, for example. There are so many of these parables, not because there's only one pitfall into which a rich man may fall in many circumstances, that is just being rich, but rather there are so many pitfalls into which a rich man may fall in each and every one circumstance, isn't there? One of those many pitfalls of riches is here described. And pitfall here is translated as evil in our text. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it weighs heavy upon mankind. Quite simply, money can't buy happiness. Huh? Good summary of this section. Right? Right, Adeline? Yeah. Money can't buy happiness. We can all go home now? Not quite. Not quite yet. Diachronic linguists have traced this phrase to the biblical concept articulated here. A man might have all the fruits of his labor, but be unable to relish them. What a disaster. To have purchased a bottle of Chateau Lafite Rothschild 1928, that's a French Bordeaux that's now priced at $4,325 a bottle, and suddenly we'll lose one's sense of taste. Oh, très tragique, right? To have risen to the heights of Beethoven, having composed his Fifth Symphony, unable to hear it, having gone deaf. To have accumulated the wealth of J.P. Morgan and unable to enjoy it. He had a bad stomach. He had wrenching ulcers. He suffered from a number of ailments, not only ulcers, but the rosacea, if you've ever read a biography of him, which afflicted his nose with a bulbous red color that prevented him from relishing his extravagant wealth during the Gilded Age. He used to stare you down because he had this big red bulbous nose. And people would, of course, see it and stare at it, and he would just glare at you, staring at him. One of the most bitter, resentful men with his wealth that ever existed. He's a parable in America. Although one of the most wealthy men of the 19th century, he was also widely acknowledged to be one of the most personally miserable men to have lived at that time. Well, this is the circumstance described by Solomon here in these verses. A type A personality is sketched here, a dude with money, all the latest gadgets, the kind of fame that keeps him on cable and satellite channels 24/7. He's the kind of person who's able to actually get everything he imagines he wants. Cars, girls, iPhones, money, and the adulation of the fawning mainstream press. Kind of sounds like Donald Trump, doesn't it? Yet at the true moment of fulfillment, of consummation, true realization of all the grandiose imaginings of what it means to be successful, all is stolen from him. Just when he thinks he can spend to get, own to keep, and bask in the sunlight of the adulation of the media, someone else robs him of it. We've kind of observed this phenomena in the back and forth of the Republican nomination process, haven't we? One day it seems that Mitt Romney, the son of a former governor and successful businessman in his own right, will walk away with the nomination for president. Then another, like Newt Gingrich, will win in a surprise victory, steal it from Romney, right? But then another one like Rick Santorum or Ron Paul will take more and more votes such that it was entirely unclear yet who's going to prevail, right? But this is a good deal more serious than that here, the circumstance with our rich man. God does not give him power, that is the absolute circumstances, to control his wealth. God does not give him power to enjoy them. That's the sense of power here. The ability to control the circumstances, control freaks, listen. The ability to control the circumstances that governs your wealth. Isn't this what so many men strive for, don't they? Huh? To be able to acquire, grow, and sustain their wealth? Isn't this why so many financial institutions seek to convey this image of sobriety and competence and conservative wisdom? This is why banks are built to appear solid and enduring, lasting with their Greek columns and their marble walls, and why bankers dress in Brooke Brothers suits and have pictures of their wife and family on their large mahogany desks. But then what happens? What happens so often, huh? Men like Barney Frank and Chris Dodd in Congress end up destroying the value of your house through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Men like Ben Bernanke sap the value of your savings by cultivating the inflation of your currency. Men like Bernie Madoff end up stealing your investments in Ponzi schemes. A stranger enjoys them in the end, right? Poof. All for which you've striven all your life is gone. That's one of the themes throughout Ecclesiastes, isn't it? This is the way of the world, under the sun, if you will, a grievous evil. And note how he aptly denotes it. This is vain. It's not vain, is it? It's not meaningless. No, it is precisely what we've been calling it, vaporous. Poof. So short-lived. The wealth in which this man trusted is brief, fleeting, gone with the wind. Then Koheleth piles on the hyperbole. He says, though such a one fathers 100 children and lives many years and even has no burial, a sign that one is cursed, of course, as we see throughout Scripture. Solomon is so bold to declare, I say, and he's emphatic here, that's emphatically placed in the Hebrew, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. Childbirth has been and still is the most deadly threshold of life for both mother and child. Throughout history, more women and babies have died in childbirth than in any other circumstance for women and children. It is still the most dangerous threshold, even with contemporary medicine and methods, still the most dangerous threshold for babies in America, owing to the wicked practice of abortion, where over 1 million of babies are aborted each year. There is a price to pay. There is a price to pay yet in this country for abortion. Throughout the scriptures, the stillborn child is a metaphor for the present misery of the one who employs that metaphor. Who potentially could be more miserable than the little one who comes in vapor, briefly, fleetingly, not vainly or meaninglessly, but fleetingly, goes in darkness where only darkness knows its day? It's a metaphor for a real substantial identity, which, of course, the stillborn child lacks, at least under the sun. Who never sees the sun, nor has it ever seen anything, nor known anything of a good, sweet life, has it? Certainly nothing could be worse, right? Nothing could be worse? Wrong. In the mind of the grieved, this poor, pitiful creature is better off than he. Why? How could this be? Well, it, that is the stillborn child, finds rest rather than he. Finds rest. That's the theme. Throughout, with the stillborn child in comparison to the person in grief, right? At least the stillborn child has rest. I do not have rest. That was Job's complaint as well, wasn't it? The rich man cannot enjoy his estate, cannot relish the good things of life, finds them slipping through his fingers. Even as J.P. Morgan couldn't enjoy all of the rich repasts laid before him because of his ulcers. Finds that bone slipping from his jaws when he sees the reflection in the river and he opens his mouth to grasp the illusory bone and the reflection. Loses the one in his mouth, right from Aesop's fable. Has holes in his pockets and purse. Comes home to find the thief has plundered his estate. And he opens his 401k statement to find that Barney Frank, Chris Dodd, and Bernie Madoff and Ben Bernanke have conspired to fritter away his retirement. There is no rest for such a man. But there is, at least for this stillborn child. Thus, he is better off than such a rich man. Even the prophet Jeremiah, we've seen Job use this metaphor. Jeremiah uses it as well for his circumstance. He says, "Cursed the day I was born. Cursed be the man who informed my father, a son is born to you. For he did not kill me in the womb with my mother as my grave," Jeremiah complains. So once more, it's this sense of brevity, vaporousness, accentuated in this concluding metaphor too. Though such a man live 1,000 years, twice over, the ultimate in longevity. Yet and still, the vaporous life of the stillborn child, the ultimate in brief, right, would still be better than his, precisely because the stillborn child rests in peace. Unlike the rich man, whose 2 millennia are filled with turbulence and anxiety and restlessness. How ephemeral is peace, right? How ephemeral is peace with a prosperous estate? How brief its enjoyment. That brings us to point number 2, verses 7 through 9. There is a great irony in the destiny of the wise man as well, in that the fleeting life of the fool is a little different than his, at least in regards to its enjoyment and vaporousness. The destiny of the wise man is as fleeting as the life of the fool. Koheleth scratches an itch here in our understanding of the human appetite. That is, we know that we are yet in a sin-cursed world as long as we sate the appetite. The stomach is the metaphor employed here. And that appetite returns. Isn't that the essence of irony? We speak of full stomachs. I love eating Italian because 2 or 3 days later you're hungry again. We speak of full stomachs, satisfied sexual urges, stimulated taste buds, the itch that needs scratching, the comfort of a hug or a touch, the pleasured ear with music, the contentment of a good night's sleep. Yet each and one, every one of these appetites, we're a bag of appetites, aren't we? Returns within hours, if not moments. This is the sense of all the toil, once again, all the toil of a man. It's a motif, isn't it? A man's work, a man's labor. All the toil of man is for his mouth. That is to satisfy his hunger. Yet his appetite is not satisfied. That is, hunger returns. Satisfaction is vaporous and brief again, isn't it? Now, it's within the narrow compass of a man's appetites that Koheleth compares the wise man and the fool here. We're not, if you've been reading and sensitive to Koheleth, and you're not just isolating on this one text, he's not comparing the wise man and the fool, absolutely. He's comparing them within the brief compass of their appetites. Context determines the meaning here. Elsewhere, he lauds the benefits of wisdom over folly. So don't go running off crying, vanity, vanity, all is vanity, meaningless, meaningless, all is meaningless. If you compare the appetites of the wise man and the fool, they're substantially the same, aren't they? Both have them, both seek to satisfy them. One could perhaps do it a little more completely and pleasurably with wealth, but they all have appetites and they both seek to satisfy them. Elsewhere, Solomon contrasts this pursuit, too, in the context of the wise man and the fool. I love this proverb. There's one on my computer, Proverbs 12:11. The one working his land will be satisfied with food, but the one pursuing fantasies lacks discernment. I love that one. That's right over the plate, I tell you. The one working his land will be satisfied with food. With my wife's labors, we have a freezer full of chicken and good eggs. Have you tasted the eggs that come from Debbie's chickens? Substantially better than store-bought eggs. And goat milk is good. Goat meat is good, too. But the one pursuing fantasies lacks discernment. We need to put this one up in our session meetings, don't you think, Brian? That's good advice, the one pursuing fantasies. Every man who's making a big decision, big changes in your life, you need to put this on the mirror, maybe, where you shave in the morning. Are you pursuing a fat? Do you have the discernment to know whether you are satisfying your family with food or whether you're pursuing a fantasy? And here the contrast in Ecclesiastes is between the sated appetite and its swift return. Satisfaction, contentment is ever so brief, isn't it? And it is the same for the wise man and for the fool. In this regard, there's no advantage to being wise or foolish. Both have appetites, both seek to sate them, and both find the contentment achieved to be brief, transitory, and ephemeral, don't they? Ephemeral. Brings us to point 3, verses 10 to 12. Ephemeral. Poof, away it goes. Seems so permanent. Seemed like I could rely on that 401k to retire on. What's happened to it? Ephemeral. How ephemeral are riches, are they? There is great irony also in the destiny of the average man in that the higher life of the strong is longer than his. At least it seems that way. Thematic with the wresting of one's wealth by another that he then consequently enjoys, Koheleth pits a strong man with a weak man. That is the average Joe. You and me, who's largely powerless to resist the advances of the rapacious strong man. Once again, an image that we see throughout Scripture. We saw it in our New Testament reading today. This is quite simply the drift of the text. It becomes a larger metaphor for the general circumstances of life, many of which can overpower a man and leave him at a disadvantage. Now, just parenthetically, if you've been tracking with us and maybe reading some commentaries along the line, when you examine the history of the interpretation of this particular text, you run across many fanciful understandings. Owing to the succinctness and the complexity of the Hebrew. You may have some footnotes in your translations because of that difficulty, but don't be distracted. Don't let your interpretation of this text be distracted. Frederick and Estes, I quote from their commentary, I couldn't resist it. He said, "The frugality of the 15 Hebrew words in verse 10 has somehow produced a proliferation of large, historic, dramatic, and theological interpretations that span the Garden of Genesis to the ash heap of Job," he says. But don't be distracted. The actual interpretation, understanding is quite simple. They say historic allusions are counterproductive here. Solomon is here communicating the uncertainty of the future and the relative insecurity of all we think to be so sure under the sun. The relative insecurity of all that we think to be so sure under the sun. And this is a major feature of the cycle of life, is it not? Whatever has come to be, the text says, whatever has come to be, that is all of life that we can understand and experience under the sun, whatever has come to be, has already been named, that is, classified and brought to our understanding. That's the sense of being named. In the very statement of the cyclical nature of things, here's irony again. In the very statement of the cyclical nature of things, Koheleth is repeating in cycle this theme that he's already introduced. Remember back in chapter 1, he says, what has been will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it can be said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. He's bringing that theme back. Do you think it's the last time we'll see it? No. This theme will come back too, as all the others have. Koheleth is returning to this can in the road. He's kicking it a little further down the road. He'll kick other cans periodically. There is forward progress too, so this is not a pagan cyclical movement of history. And because of this repetitive nature of man's life and experience too. Because man's life is precisely like this, isn't it? Because our life is like this, it is known what man is. Ecclesiastes says, Koheleth says, it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The one is left deliberately ambiguous. Many of your translations have one man, perhaps one thing, becoming a metaphor then for forces and circumstances beyond which men have no control at all. Who can predict the future? In modern culture, we have developed a financial instrument to try and mollify the effects of an uncertain future, don't we? We buy insurance. That word sounds so good, doesn't it? Insurance. I feel better already. I'm insured. I'm assured that all my needs, every contingent has been provided for. We buy insurance so that if our car wrecks, our house burns down, or, God forbid, the breadwinner in the family suddenly dies, we can make up for the loss. But this word insurance is a falsely reassuring term, isn't it? Just think. Have you ever gotten a car back from the shop after an accident running exactly like it did before? Or who comes away from an accident, for that matter, untouched by injury of some sort, at least mentally, psychologically, if not physically? Or who has ever gotten the commensurate value for their home lost to disaster? Or ever replaced to their complete satisfaction all of the stuff that they lost, say in a fire? Whoever completely recovers even from such a major tragic loss? Or, God forbid, what wife or child who has lost a beloved husband and a father ever had their grief sated by the insurance check, huh? Or been able to replace them with a stepfather or a subsequent spouse? Who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? Oh, Koheleth exclaims. And this uncertainty is punctuated further with other uncertainty. He says, who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vaporous, not vain, not meaningless, not vain, not meaningless, but vaporous, right? Who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vaporous life? See how much better that fits? I hope you're persuaded, if you haven't been persuaded yet. Which passes like a shadow, once again, brevity, emphasizing the ephemeral nature of life, like a shadow. That's an image you see all through Scripture too. David says on numbers of places, just a couple of samples from Psalm 102, he says, my life passes quickly like the evening shadows. He says in Psalm 109, I fade like a shadow at dusk. Job says later in chapter 8, our days on earth are as fleeting as a shadow. So in the light of this then, can we really say, no one knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his life? No one knows? Have we come to this? Are we just going to sit there and say, yeah, I guess no one knows, right? Now, that's the counsel of a fool. If we've been reading correctly and rightly up to this point, we'll say, yes, there is a way to live. He's already been demonstrating this for us, hasn't he? We know now that it is requisite that we work diligently to build our estate, enjoy our work, and its fruits. Go home today, bake some bread, open a bottle of red wine, or white wine. Relax, enjoy your family, enjoy the fruits of your labor today. Trusting then the vagaries of life to all the all-wise providence of God. We're going to reference this a little later in our Sunday school class because we'll be talking about the providence of God. That looms over this whole text, the idea that there is something above the sun. The wise man will build his estate, enjoy his work and its fruits. He'll do that temporally and wisely, trusting the vagaries of life to the all-wise providence of God. This Koheleth expects us to extrapolate from what he's already covered. The fool is vapid and silly, and he will not remember from a few chapters back. And so he'll just say, yeah, I guess no one knows. This is wisdom literature, after all. This text is one that begs us to look above the sun and see the providential hand of an all-wise God, for it is God you must fear, he says. Remember just one chapter back? It is God you must fear. He is in heaven and you are on earth. So Solomon is utterly consistent here. He's utterly consistent with our theme. That is, life is brief and uncertain. While we know what is in store, because what has been will return to begin again. You know, he struggles with this. We do know what's coming, because what has been will return to be again, but no one can predict when, where, and how. That's the rub, and it's also brief. So then, we should already be casting our gaze to the horizon and looking above the sun. That is, to the one who will usher in an eternal kingdom to supplant this transient, ephemeral one. Koheleth's Proverbs, they should be acting as goads, right? Other words, other places, he even uses that phrase, that these are like goads to us. Are they not to prod our dull hearts, our dull minds, to doing precisely this? Looking above the sun. This is in part the nature and function of wisdom literature. It is to provoke you, to prod you, to stimulate you, to cause you to think beyond the page. And of course, referencing again that first introductory sermon, this is precisely what Solomon is trying to do with his sons, right? His dull and wicked sons, for that matter. Provoking them to wisdom, hopefully. Well then, who would be the king to do this then? Usher in this promised kingdom where, he says, God promised David, I will establish the throne of that one forever. I will establish the throne of his kingdom, that one, the one that's coming, forever. Solomon hoped it would be one of his sons, one of his foolish, wicked, tragically so sons. And many in our day still wrestle with these very issues, the things that we've been combing through haven't we? Are these issues that just we face here in this congregation? No. I dare say people at your workplace, living next door to you, family members, wrestle with the very things that we've been talking about today, whether it be stillborn babies or a bad job. So, I would just exhort you, this is an evangelistic book. Point them then with this text to this true Son of David then, because he has come. And he will usher in the eternal kingdom, not the ephemeral kingdom, but the eternal kingdom. As he says in Revelation 22, "Behold, I am coming soon, bringing my recompense with me." That's why we need to fear God as well. He is in heaven, we are on earth. He is bringing his recompense with him to repay everyone for what he has done. "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end," he declares. "I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you about these things for the churches. I am the root and the descendant of David," he says. "I am the root and descendant of David." Here is this one, Jesus the Christ, the bright morning star, dear brothers and sisters. So come to him today, all who hunger and thirst. Be baptized. Have your babies baptized. Bring them into covenant. And then you will find your appetite sated. That appetite for spiritual food and spiritual drink, even as Christ bid the woman at the well. Come for the water then that satisfies. And let us come to that place then where we find satisfaction for